Welcome to the Washington Watch News Desk. I'm Sarah Holliday with today's top stories. The Democrats are protesting fighting crime. Yes, that's correct. President Donald Trump has deployed 800 National Guard members across Washington, D.C. for a 30-day mission to tackle violent crime. Sounds like a practical step, right? Well, not everybody agrees. Protesters have taken to the streets, slamming the initiative as over the top. To them, Trump's push for safety somehow makes him and his supporters fascists. But the pushback doesn't stop at grassroots outrage. When Trump requested an extension to keep fighting the crime, Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said, "No way," except he used vulgar profanity to get his point across. He also vowed to fight tooth and nail on this. Now, let's step back from the heated rhetoric and look at the bigger picture. There's more to this story than what meets the eye. On Wednesday's broadcast of NPR's All Things Considered, a national correspondent shed light on a troubling reality.
People in Congress Heights said crime is a really big problem there. Shootings, robbery, burglaries. In fact, some say crime is worse than the statistics show because many say have given up reporting to police because they feel a lot of crimes go unpunished.
Despite the controversy, the situation on the ground tells a different story. As the NPR correspondent just highlighted, many D.C. residents are living in fear, feeling so defeated by crime that they've stopped reporting it altogether. And so, many do welcome Trump's efforts to restore security. Opinions may be divided, but one truth stands out. The concern about crime is real, and solutions are urgently needed. Now, let's shift gears to a global stage that's got everyone's attention. All eyes are locked on today's meeting between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. The air is thick with anticipation, and frankly, no one knows what's going to happen. Whispers are swirling that Putin might want to propose a nuclear deal with the U.S. Adding to the intrigue, he's reportedly been in close contact with North Korean President Kim Jong-un, having called the communist leader earlier this week. Many see this as yet another sign of their deepening alliance. How could these developments shape President Trump's mission to broker peace between Ukraine and Russia? This is our final look at the situation before the big sit-down, so stay tuned. We'll bring you a full update on Monday. Turning back to America, get this. Nearly 275,000 illegal immigrants have been removed from the country's Social Security program. You're probably thinking, if they're illegal, why were they there in the first place? Bingo, that's the great mystery, isn't it? In any case, Trump addressed it during a press conference.
To protect our benefits, we've already kicked nearly 275,000 illegal aliens off of the Social Security system. Biden never kicked anybody off. Everybody joined. And we're carrying out historic deportations to remove many more illegals committing Social Security fraud. It's the Social Security fraud that was taking place at levels that nobody's ever seen.
It turns out the Trump administration isn't stopping at Social Security reform. They're also zeroing in on so-called sanctuary cities that prioritize illegal immigrants. Attorney General Pam Bondi announced it loud and clear. Any sanctuary jurisdiction that continues to put illegal aliens ahead of American citizens can either come to the table or see us in court. Demand letters have been sent to sanctuary cities, counties, and states nationwide. Bondi warned that states like California could lose billions in federal funding if they don't abandon their sanctuary policies. So far, California Governor Gavin Newsom is the only one to have received an official letter from Bondi, but with the effort spanning from coast to coast, other states can expect to hear from her soon. And those are today's headlines. I'm Sarah Holliday. Dive deeper with The Washington Stand at WashingtonStand.com. Up next is Washington Watch with guest host Jody Heiss. We're back Monday with more stories that matter.
From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Sitting in for Tony is today's host, Jody Heiss.
Well, good afternoon. Hard to believe Friday is already here, but happy Friday to you. Welcome to this edition of Washington Watch. I am Jody Heiss, senior fellow here at the Family Research Council and your Friday host. A lot coming your way today. We'll start with what's happening this very moment. President Trump and Vladimir Putin are in a high-stakes talk over a potential ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine in the war that is now over 3 years old. So what would a successful summit look like?
What will make a success of this summit today? I can't tell you that. I don't know. There's nothing set in stone, but I want to see a ceasefire rapidly. I don't know if it's going to be today, but I'm not going to be happy if it's not today. Everyone said it can't be today, but I'm just saying I want the killing to stop. I'm in this to stop the killing.
That, of course, was President Trump. He was speaking earlier today, commenting on what his vision of success would look like. And Congresswoman Claudia Tenney will be joining me in just a few moments with a Capitol Hill reaction to it all.
We saw that Russia continued its violence into Ukraine last night, launching even more drones. What did you make of that?
I think they're trying to negotiate. He's trying to set a stage. I mean, in his mind, that helps him make a better deal. It actually hurts him. But in his mind, that helps him make a better deal if they could continue the killing.
So a little bit later today, retired Brigadier General John Tykert will join me and offer his analysis of the talks between Putin and Trump. And what could a peace deal signal to other adversaries, specifically countries like China and Iran and North Korea? And then right here at home, a battle continues between Texas and California, an arms race of their own, if you will, over redistricting efforts, which, of course, is being supported by President Trump. Just yesterday, though, California Governor Gavin Newsom riled up a rally of supporters in Los Angeles over his redistricting duel that is now taking place with Texas.
We can't stand back and watch this democracy disappear district by district all across this country, not just in Texas, but in Missouri, where J.D. Vance went just a week ago, in Indiana, in places like Ohio, in places like Florida. We need to stand up, not just California. Other blue states need to stand up. We need to be firm in our resolve.
Other blue states need to stand up. So could this be the start of a nationwide tit-for-tat redistricting battle? And it certainly seems Governor Newsom is open to that idea.
If Trump is doing this, he's not going to stop with Texas. Are you calling on other blue states to do this now?
I think you got to meet fire with fire. I mean, this is a break-the-glass moment for our democracy, for our nation. The world's watching us. And so, absolutely.
So FRC Action's director, Matt Carpenter, will be joining me with all the latest in the redistricting wars that are taking place. And then we'll close out the program today, as we always do, with a worldview discussion. And since it's back to school season, Summit Ministries Dr. Jeff Myers will join me and share his thoughts on how to help young people form a biblical worldview while they face all sorts of faith challenges in school and the world today. So, of course, we've got a lot coming your way in the next hour. We thank you for joining us. If by chance you miss any portion of it, you can go back and catch it at our website, tonyperkins.com. And let me also just say this. I'll touch on this a little bit more. But today marks a very, very special day of memory for FRC. And it's something that I will share with you a little bit later. All right, let's jump into the program for today. As I mentioned, today is finally here. It's the day that's been much anticipated. Anchorage, Alaska, the location of a summit between President Trump and Russian leader Vladimir Putin. It's taking place at the Joint Base Elmendore Richardson, by the way. That is a place that was crucial to the U.S. efforts to counter the then Soviet Union during the Cold War. Ironic that it's taking place there. But the two men met earlier this afternoon for a face-to-face talk and a joint conference that is scheduled to take place later. So noticeably absent in all of this, of course, is Ukrainian President Zelensky, who was not invited to this meeting. So what might be the next steps that we will see in this historic meeting? Well, here now to discuss this is Congresswoman Claudia Tenney. She's a member of the House Ways and Means Committee, as well as the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the Space Technology Committee as well, Science, Space, and Technology. She's also the founder of the Friends of Judea and Samaria Caucus, and we appreciate that. She represents the 24th Congressional District of the Great Empire State. Congresswoman Tenney, welcome back to Washington Watch. Great to see you again.
Great to see you. Haven't seen you in a while.
It's been a long time. All right, so let's just jump into this. Vladimir Putin, can he be trusted, do you think, to be an honest broker in these talks?
Absolutely not. I think that Trump knows that, and I think the people working with Trump on setting up this meeting. But it is an attempt by President Trump, which is extremely, audacious, you might say. I mean, he's very hopeful that this will at least begin the process of getting Putin kind of finding out. I think Trump indicated a number of times where Putin is, kind of to gauge him. I think Trump likes face-to-face meetings to really get a feel, to see where his weaknesses are and his strengths are, his body language. You know, Trump is an expert at that. He's got very good intuitive sensitivity. So I think right now, I mean, that's really what he's trying to do is assess Putin. I know Putin has taken on a lot of incoming. They have over 400,000 Russians have been killed. The economy is struggling, and Putin is, taken over some parts of Ukraine, but this is essential. And we look at it differently. I mean, President Trump wants to stop the killing. He wants to save lives. He's compassionate, cares about the human loss. I mean, of course, Russia doesn't care about that, especially a KGB, former KGB agent. You know, Vladimir Putin cares about power and projecting strength around the world stage, even though they have a very small economy. You know, he's been very successful at manipulating democracies around the world, including Europe and, in fact, the Democrats in the United States, with the climate change agenda and talking everyone into abandoning their natural gas exploration, their oil exploration, and things that would, be a threat to Russia's economic strength. And now President Trump has brought the opposite in. He's talking about, unleashing American energy, bringing back the dominance that we need, making our European allies bring more money to the table to defend this European's threat, through Ukraine, the largest country in Europe. So a lot of really interesting things happening here, and it affects the geopolitical landscape as well. So I find it really fascinating. Will be interesting to see where this goes next. I know we're not done yet. Trump is still behind the doors. I think they're just coming out. Maybe there'll be a couple interviews, and we'll see what President Trump has to say and what he can report on. I know that's a lot, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, that is a lot, and there is a lot going on, and I appreciate that. Do you have a sense of what you kind of expect to come out of this, or are you just all in a wait-and-see mode?
I think Trump is going to have a lot to say about where he is. Maybe he won't reveal so much. I know he's doing some interviews with media, but I think he's going to get a feel of whether Putin is in a position where he feels like he needs to come up with some kind of deal. He needs to come up with a way to stop the hemorrhaging that Russia is experiencing, potentially. And I think that's where Trump's trying to assess that. And then that's why I think he's meeting with Putin individually, and that's why he'll eventually, if it gets to that point, and the talks move forward, there will ultimately be a meeting with President Trump and Zelensky. So Putin, obviously, but I think that right now this is the first step into what could be a longer process. Obviously, Trump likes to get things done quickly, but I think this is very complicated. Remember, he ran and said, "I can have this war over in 24 hours, and now he's admitted on many occasions that this is going to be a little more complicated, a little more difficult, because Vladimir Putin is a little bit different animal than dealing with other leaders in other parts of the world.
Yep, absolutely. Congresswoman Tenney, if I can shift gears to another part of the world with you, I know you have been just a stalwart supporter of Israel, and of course they are expanding housing right now in Judea and Samaria as part of their push to exert their rightful sovereignty in the region there. And our State Department recently confirmed that this expansion of housing is certainly in line with the Trump administration's goals. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, I think this is very large. I was just in Israel for 10 days. And, you know, as you cited at the top of the show, I started the Judea and Samaria Caucus and, you know, looking for partners all around the world to start telling the truth, really, about what's going on in Israel. You know, there's so many lies being told by so many media entities. People don't know the truth. They don't understand, you know, the real nature of the war that Israel is fighting for the preservation of Western civilization, actually. They're fighting in that front as the only democracy in the entire Middle East to try to actually provide democratic principles to everyone in Israel, regardless of your race, regardless of your religion. And I think it's really interesting, but there is a movement, and I think that's why this E1, this section of Jerusalem and continuing with building there sets a mark that says Jerusalem is the capital of the Jewish state. Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and it's going to remain that way. It should not be divided. And I think this is what this latest development is coming out of Israel. And I think it's important that we continue to recognize the area of Judea and Samaria. I also put a bill in Congress that would require the United States to list in any of its official documents the area of Judea and Samaria as Judea and Samaria, not the pejorative West Bank, because we want to recognize this as the Jewish homeland. And I'll tell you something really interesting that happened to me. I was over in Israel, and this has been sort of, this idea has been floating around. I met with a number of Arab sheikhs in the region of Judea and Samaria, and the so-called within the Green Line, and they were very adamant about their interest in working with the state of Israel, their lack of trust and their interest in dissolving the Palestinian Authority and working with the state of Israel in a sort of quasi emirates type of model where the sheikhs can have their emirates model within the state of Israel, with Israel providing security and them having sort of a quasi sovereignty and getting rid of what they defined as the corrupt Palestinian Authority, which is preventing them from seeking and attaining any kind of prosperity for the people where they live. They want to live in harmony with their Jewish neighbors. They want to be able to get involved in businesses. They want to grow jobs. They want to bring industry into this whole region in Hebron and Judea and Samaria. Really fascinating, novel idea that we are going to be talking about, obviously, with President Trump and his team. And this could actually be, in a strange way, it could be a solution to what this, you know, has been plaguing Israel, you know, for decades and decades and decades, with no solution and the constant harangue of a two-state solution, which we know is impossible in a situation where Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, and all these other, you know, Iran-backed proxies are making it impossible to have any kind of peace in the Middle East and any kind of hope for a two-state solution. Really interesting developments that are happening right now in Israel, really novel concepts. And we're just going to see where this goes. But, you know, this could be the actually right, peaceful solution to the future.
Wow, so much happening around the world. And then you have some of our allies now going to recognize a Palestinian state. I mean, there's so many complicated issues in all of this. And it's something we'll certainly be watching. I want to thank you so much, Congresswoman Tenney, for joining us today on Washington Watch. We appreciate it a great deal.
Thank you so much, and great to see you, and God bless.
Likewise. All right, friends, coming up on the other side of the break, retired Brigadier General John Tykert is going to assess the talks between Presidents Trump and Putin from a military standpoint. So you don't want to miss that discussion, and we'll bring it your way right here on the other side of the break. Stay tuned.
Family is the oldest, most tested, and most reliable unit of society. It is divinely created and sustained. And yet, there are those who are always tampering with its values and structure. That's why we need organizations like the Family Research Council that can effectively defend and strengthen the family.
Family Research Council began over 40 years ago, like all great movements of God, with prayer. Today, rooted in the heart of the nation's capital, FRC continues to champion faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview.
FRC is one of those bright lights that helps us focus on true north. And I shudder to think, had they not been here, that it could have been worse.
The Family Research Council is key. It's one of a handful of groups that I think will determine whether our children live in a country that enjoyed all of the freedom and all the opportunity that we enjoyed in this great land.
It's just a wonderful parachurch organization that doesn't seek to take the place of the church, but it seeks to assist the family and the church as we try to move forward successfully, not in a defensive mode, but in an offensive mode as we seek to live our lives according to the Holy Scriptures.
FRC is not going to be whooped. we're going to fight. We're going to take a stand. And again, we don't retreat.
You will never see in front of this building here in Washington, D.C., a white flag fly. We will never step back. We will never surrender. And we will never be silent.
In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory. Family Research Council invites you to join our Stand on the Word Bible reading plan as we reflect upon the life of Jesus, the Word who dwelt among us. Come with us and discover the glory of the Word. Read the Gospels and witness the life-changing story of Jesus, His life, death, and resurrection. Come read how Jesus transformed the lives of common people and how those same people transformed the known world through the power of the Holy Spirit. Come with us for 10 to 15 minutes a day and read the entire New Testament before the new year. Find our Bible reading plan and daily devotionals from Tony Perkins at frc.org/Bible. Join us and stand on the Word.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Jody Heiss, your Friday host, and an honor to have you with us today. All right, I want to continue our discussion on the historic meeting that's taking place even as we speak between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. You may recall this is the first meeting between the two of them since Putin's invasion of Ukraine back in 2022. And so what is the Russians' end game from a military perspective? We're here now to discuss this with me is retired Brigadier General John Tykert. He's former Assistant Deputy Undersecretary for the Air Force for International Affairs. General Tykert, welcome back to Washington Watch. An honor to have you.
Jody, thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
Okay, so what do you expect is going to happen during this summit?
Jody, I think the president has been very clear that he is not there to negotiate. He is there to set conditions so that there can be a follow-on meeting that includes President Zelensky so that Russia and Ukraine can negotiate together. But I also think the president has been very clear that if he doesn't see real tangible outcomes that demonstrate either an immediate ceasefire or an agreement or commitment to have that follow-on negotiation, then he's going to be not just extremely disappointed, but he's going to continue to feel disrespected by Putin, who thus far has negotiated and acted in bad faith. And that will mean that the United States will levy some of these additional elements of national power into the mix, including sanctions and secondary sanctions, to raise the pain threshold for Putin so he realizes it is in his best interest to either accept the ceasefire or to start really negotiating in good faith.
Yeah, I think those sanctions and so forth could be very detrimental to already a fragile economy that they have there. So what do you think? Is it as obvious as it looks, but what is Putin's end game with these talks? What is he hoping to come away with?
Jody, I think that he has been mystified during these last 3.5 years that somehow the mighty Russian power hasn't been able to subjugate Ukraine. And frankly, there's no future on the horizon in which he would be able to do so. So either now the outcome is Putin hoping to dazzle President Trump, he's hoping to delay, he's hoping to maybe create a wedge issue between the United States and Ukraine or the United States and Europe, and all of those things are in his repertoire, But I think President Trump is very clear-eyed in his desire to see that ceasefire or commitment for follow-on negotiations. And anything short of that, he will see through President Putin as just a delay tactic in his negotiation plan of bad faith.
Okay, very interesting. You know, I think also, I think he wants some sort of concessions. Do you think there's a scenario where Putin might feel emboldened by keeping some of the territory that he feels he's conquered?
I think there's a lot of maneuver room once we get Ukraine in the room to discuss geography, security, and economy and elements within those three areas to find a way to end this war. But I very much believe that President Trump is not there now to negotiate. And while Putin may try to push him on accepting concessions, that the president of the United States thus far showing that he is in his home field advantage with a position of strength is not going to get pushed around by Putin, is going to insist either on that ceasefire or the commitment for follow-on negotiations that include Ukraine.
Very good point. Very good point. All right. So how do we handle these talks and what may come out of it, specifically as it relates to a greater adversary, China? What wrong signals perhaps are at stake in these talks that can be messaged and received by China?
Jody, I think it's important to realize that China is watching, but not just these talks, but they've been watching for the last 3.5 years to see how the United States follows on its commitments. By the way, Xi Jinping and China were watching 2 months ago when the United States launched those 7B2s and dropped those massive ordnance penetrators in Iran. And I think all of those things demonstrate both the strength of capability from the United States and a strength of will. And those are the two primary elements that create deterrence or the ability to stop somebody from doing the things that you don't want them to do. And if we negotiate from a position of strength and we continue to demonstrate through our words and our actions commitment and strength, then it puts China and others like Iran or like North Korea on their back foot, realizing that the United States continues to have not just escalation dominance, but also is exuding a position of deterrence so that they must not do the things we do not want them to do.
And don't you think at the same time, the fact that President Trump has been having conversations with leaders throughout Europe, that Europe is uniting together as a strength of their own, like we've not seen in a long time, that comes into play with all of this as well, doesn't it?
Well, I think that it does, Jody. And I think that in a lot of ways, Putin's already lost this war, that we added 2 new members to NATO, Finland and Sweden. And we have seen a consolidation of European strength and a commitment to raise their defense spending now to that 5% threshold. All of those have come partly because President Trump has encouraged them to do that, but also because they've seen that the world is a dangerous place with people like Putin, Xi, and others. And the more the world is a dangerous place, the more good, strong partnerships like NATO and our European allies will bind and bond together to make sure that they're able, again, to enhance that deterrent posture that the United States already exudes well in our own situation.
All right, last question real quickly, and we've only got about a minute. How could this have other repercussions, rippling effect beyond this meeting? I'm thinking specifically China, maybe the Uyghur population there. Where do the rippling effects, repercussions go, you think?
Jody, I do think it's interesting that we've talked a little bit in the last year and a half in the national security spheres about this axis between Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. But I think what we saw a couple months ago in Iran is that the big dogs, Russia and China, didn't jump in to help their partner. And I think this axis is extremely superficial and it really is transactional. It's not a deep trusting partnership like the United States has with its allies and partners. It is something that is extremely transactional. And frankly, all of those entities that I mentioned will walk away if they don't see in their best interest to continue to add benefit to that axis.
Thank you so much, Brigadier General John Tykert, for your expertise. Fascinating conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody.
All right, next on Washington Watch, FRC Matt Carpenter will join me to talk about all the redistricting taking place in Texas. Stay tuned.
Download the new Stand Firm app for Apple and Android phones today. You can join a wonderful community of fellow believers. We've created a special place for you to access news from a biblical perspective. Read and listen to daily devotionals, pray for current events, and more. Share the Stand Firm app with your friends, family, and church members. And of course, stand firm wherever you go.
At Family Research Council, defending the family isn't just a mission, it's our daily calling. Every team member at FRC uses their God-given talents to stand for biblical truth, protect life, and uphold religious freedom.
Here at Family Research Council, we face many threats to the family, threats that have been with us for some time. Abortion, the gender ideology threat, the attacks on marriage, the attacks on parental authority, and the attacks on religious freedom. We have to promote, support, strengthen, and incentivize family growth so families take their place in society in a place of honor.
I'm defending the family by working in the Center for Biblical Worldview to provide cutting-edge research and resources for pastors, ministry leaders, and Christian parents.
Through my work at the Washington Stand, I passionately defend what God has defined for marriage and family. I don't see the Washington Stand as just a place to talk about cultural events. It's a place to share biblical truth. It's a perfect outlet to advance and defend what God has defined as good, true, and beautiful.
Because of you, we're able to frame things in such a way that help Christians stand for truth on the things that matter most, like life, faith, family, and freedom.
Thank you for standing with us.
Thank you for your support. It is so critical to the work that we at Family Research Council are doing day to day as we support and strengthen the family. So thank you.
You're tuned in to Washington Watch. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Jody Heiss, your Friday host. Glad to have you. All right. The Texas, what has come to be known as the Texas versus California redistricting battle, is now heating up more and more. Yesterday, Governor Gavin Newsom of California actually held a rally and a press conference in Los Angeles. And officially, that was kind of kicking off his state's redistricting push. While at the same time he was doing that, more than a dozen Border Patrol agents turned up outside the venue where he was speaking. And then all of this simultaneously is taking place while runaway Texas Democrats lawmakers are signaling, at least, their intention to return to Austin, Texas, and to put an end to their redistricting standoff. So, well, we don't know when they plan to return, but they are signaling that they want to. So are there any strings attached to these Democrats returning to Texas? And will California's threat to also redistrict play a factor in all of this? Well, joining me now to discuss the latest in this mess is FRC Actions Director Matt Carpenter. Matt, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always an honor to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jody. Great to be with you.
All right, so break it down for us. What's the latest in this saga, if you will, between these runaway Democrats?
Yeah, so what started in Texas has sort of metastasized across the country. As you pointed out, California Governor Gavin Newsom has weighed in, threatening to draw their state's districts in response to what Governor Abbott and the Texas legislature might do in a special session. Texas Democrats fled the state in order to deny the legislature a quorum to convene a special session, which has been underway. The Texas Senate passed their redistricting maps, but the Texas House has been unable to move those maps because they've not had the requisite number of state legislators present. So all eyes have been on these Texas Democrats who fled the state. There's a report yesterday that this group of legislators, these Texas Democrats, have outlined some conditions upon which they might return to the state, and those being, one, that the current special session adjourn. It just so happens that the special session did adjourn today. And the other condition is that California announced their plans for redistricting. And you played that clip earlier, Gavin Newsom. He's itching up. They're gearing up to go tit for tat here with Texas.
So when are these Democrats expected back? I've not seen, I've seen that they're signaling that they're going to come back, but do we know when? And you said the special session ended today. Is there another one to follow right now?
Yeah, so the Texas Democrats who've fled the state, there are some reports out there that they might return this weekend. I haven't seen any updates since then, so I assume they'll be headed back to the Lone Star State in short order. But Governor Abbott has been very clear from the onset here that he's going to just call special session after special session until they get new maps. So in essence, this is maybe a publicity stunt at most. If you'll remember back in 2021, they pulled a similar stunt. They came to D.C. In protest of Governor Abbott calling a special session to take up legislation to enhance the state's election integrity laws.
Wow. So, all right, let's the scenario. They come back this weekend. Another special session is called by the governor. Are the Democrats going to break quorum again?
Well, if history is any indicator, there's a strong chance they might try and pull that stunt again. They certainly seem to like the publicity to getting out of state and getting their names in the paper and raising dollars for this activity. But, you know, we've seen the Attorney General Ken Paxton, we've seen Governor Abbott, we've seen the Texas Speaker of the House also start posturing towards taking some measures, which is going to raise the consequences on these legislators if they try to play this tactic again. There's talk of arresting them, of vacating their seats. So the stakes are certainly getting raised there. I imagine that changes the calculus, and eventually they'll just cave and they'll just end up trying to make their point, as they should, as elected representatives in the state house, even if it's a losing fight.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're elected to do. So let's come back. Let's say all goes well in terms of the way Texas Republicans are hoping. How many seats are at stake here? What could be the switch from Democrat control to Republican control in Texas?
Sure. So the maps that have been circulating in Texas show a 5-seat pickup, essentially, for Republicans. If you look at the map, there typically are going to be states in the Rio Grande Valley. In past election cycles, we've just seen a tremendous swing among the Hispanic majority communities in the Rio Grande Valley towards the GOP. And so I think for Texas Republicans to look at this and say, well, you know, it seems fitting that we would draw new districts to represent this, you know, this change essentially in the voting behavior of our citizens, I think that's well founded. You've got 36 members of the Texas delegation currently, 23 are Republican, 13 are Democrat. After redistricting, you would end up with 28 Republicans and 8 Democrats.
Wow. And of course, we have all sorts of blue states now that are trying to counter all that. We've got less than a minute, Matt, but are we ever going to have fair representation again? This seems to be getting out of hand.
You know, Jody, redistricting it's just an inherently partisan process. After the 2020 census, we saw just in general, most districts were drawn to favor incumbents. Lean Republican seats became likely Republican seats. Likely Republican seats became safe Republican seats, and vice versa on the Democratic side. There's just a dwindling number of actually truly competitive races out there.
Thank you so much, Matt Carpenter, FRC Actions Director, for your updates. Appreciate it a great deal. All right, friends, coming up next, Dr. Jeff Myers from Summit Ministries will join me for our weekly Biblical Worldview segment. He'll be here right after the break, so stay with us.
Family Research Council is committed to advancing faith, family, and freedom from the East Coast to the West. So FRC is going to Southern California for this year's Pray, Vote, Stand Summit, October 17th and 18th at Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills. Join us for this powerful gathering of Christians desiring cultural renewal and spiritual revival. The Pray, Vote, Stand Summit brings together Christian leaders, issue experts, and government officials for a time of prayer, inspiration, and action. Together, we will seek God's guidance for our nation and engage in meaningful discussions on the intersection of faith, government, and culture. If the spiritual foundations and the cultural walls of our nation are to be rebuilt, we all have a role to play. May we each find our place on the wall as we build for biblical truth. Register now at PrayVoteStand.org. That's PrayVoteStand.org.
Jennifer, it's so exciting to be here with you today talking about our new book, Embracing God's Design. Who is actually going to benefit from reading this book in your view?
There are so many different audiences that can benefit. The first one are counselors themselves, right? Because we have some material in there where we really address the gender dysphoria diagnosis and what is wrong with it. We have information for people who are wanting to go back to embracing God's design for their life.
This is really magical to have the therapist and the individual who suffered come together and write about why this is happening and why we're seeing this.
And we brought all of that experience to the table. We want to see people walking in the fullness of who God has called them to be and not a false identity.
Order today at embracethedesign.com.
How should Christians think about the thorny issues shaping our culture? How should Christians address deceitful ideas like transgenderism, critical theory, or assisted suicide? How can Christians navigate raising children in a broken culture, the war on gender roles, or rebuilding our once great nation? Outstanding is a podcast from the Washington Stand dedicated to these critical conversations. Outstanding seeks to tear down what our corrupt culture lifts up, with an aim to take every thought and every idea captive to the obedience of Christ. Whether policies or partisan politics, whether conflict in America or conflict abroad, join us and our guests as we examine the headlines through the lens of Scripture and explore how Christians can faithfully exalt Christ in all of life. Follow Outstanding on your favorite podcast app and look for new episodes each week.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Jody Heiss, your Friday host, and glad to be with you today. All right, before we dive into this last segment, I want to just mention that today is the 13th anniversary of when now convicted domestic terrorist Floyd Lee Corkins targeted the Family Research Council in our D.C. headquarters back in 2012. And the intent that he had was to commit mass murder of the FRC team and then to smear Chick-fil-A sandwiches in all of the faces of his victims. But God had other plans. And due to the grace of God and the heroism of our unarmed building manager, Leo Johnson, friends, Leo was able to subdue Floyd despite the fact that Leo had been shot. He was shot in the arm, and still he was able to subdue Floyd until the police arrived. And Leo, to every one of us, is a hero, and to this day, he is still the building manager at FRC, and we literally thank God every day for Leo, his heroism, his kind, godly spirit. And we thank the Lord for his grace and goodness to us 13 years ago and for each of you who have faithfully prayed for us ever since that time for God's covering. We deeply, deeply appreciate it. But I wanted to bring that up because this is a very special day for each of us here at FRC. Okay, as we go into our final segment, and I bring in our special guest here. Many in our audience, of course, are getting all geared up for a new school year. But with each new school year and with the promises that each of those years hold for our children and grandchildren, we need to be mindful of our biblical responsibility as parents and grandparents and so forth to be the primary teachers and molders of our kids. Tony says it often that you can delegate authority of your child's education, but you cannot delegate the responsibility. And yesterday we discussed right here on this program the disturbing story of a Fairfax County, Virginia public high school where apparently a social worker there facilitated an abortion. An abortion